I'll start.
Go on.
Yeah. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello, Jamie.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Under the Cloche. How has it all been going?
Good.
Yeah?
Yeah, all right.
Good,
really
good start to the week?
Yeah.
Everyone get in safely?
Why?
That sounds loaded.
Just because I nearly didn't make it this morning.
Oh. That's like a normal morning. For, isn't it?
I'm going to phrase this correctly, for possible child abuse.
Sorry, you
said silence.
Okay, you were careful with your words.
On the train,
there.
I've had another train incident, lad.
Okay.
You're not in your best form when you commute.
No, I'm definitely not. My train line goes through Gatwick Airport. Family get on who have clearly just come back from their holidays because they're absolutely knackered and they got all their wheelies with them. So it's an absolute packed train. I managed to get a seat. So I'm sat there and there's this, I don't know, maybe like a 8-9-year-old boy who starts by sitting on the edge of the seat. I'm against the window. Anyway, as the journey goes on, I start to feel him leaning up against me. And I'm like, okay, fine. And then he starts to nod off.
Snore.
Oh.
And then he goes deep sleep because I feel the full weight of a human being just on me. I'm moving closer and closer to the window so it doesn't look weird. But then I do a little bit of that to see if I can wake him and then him reposition. But no. So he's leaning right in and I'm thinking, right, one of two things is going to happen here.
I'm going to stroke his hair.
Fight all urges to stroke his hair. But I was like, either he's going to slide off like my arm and into my lap.
Also,
I can't
not a
have
good look.
That. No, not a good look.
I can't have that.
Can't have that. Or hopefully like the train will come to like a jolt and he'll wake up. So I'm positioning my arm like that. It gets to London Bridge where I'm about to get off and he's not going anywhere. So I'm like, right, okay, I've got to get off to get the train. So I'm like, do you know what? Like, as soon as I start to move, he'll wake up, reposition, I'll stand up.
Oh, no.
It didn't happen. So I just go, right, he'll wake up. Like, I'll just go for it. He didn't wake up. I stood up and he just went thud on the seat as my bum left it. Boom, like full side of the face. And then let out like a noise that you wouldn't think. It was like a cat in distress. It was like a... Everyone looks at me. I'm stood there. He's like, what the heck's going on? No one's watched this happen. So the whole carriage is just looking at me going, well, this is my stop. I'm off. Kid looking like he's been slapped or something. And then I just left the train and bolted.
And then someone going, did you see that guy from YouTube hit that kid?
Yeah, so that was my journey in.
The good news is there's CCTV on every carriage now, so that'll be on some like...
Yeah, if you were...
Have you seen this guy kind of
If you
poster.
Work for Thameslink and you find the footage, send it in. We can overlay it on the top of my storytelling.
We can blur the faces.
Yeah.
Not yours.
Not mine.
Not yours.
See it,
yours
say it. Sorted.
I saw the best conspiracy theory the other day about that. It was someone on Reddit. Was asking, why have we stopped saying sorted at the end of when we put down a recipe? And somebody put, they stopped doing it because British Rail started doing see it, say it, sorted as their slogan.
Which is basically a counter-terrorism
correct. Yeah.
Measure yeah. that they put in place.
And they're like, somebody from Sorted confirmed that it was true. And I was like, who did that? Because that is the best conspiracy theory I've ever heard.
I think that is probably the type of thing that we said in tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah,
right?
We must have
Which
done
is like, oh, look at everyone getting on board with the word sorted.
Yeah.
Done that. Sorted.
I think we run a fine line, though, of all the stuff we put on social, of how firmly our tongues are in our cheeks and whether people truly get the sarcasm. Sarcasm is a very British thing.
It is.
It doesn't always transfer.
And it always doesn't translate on social.
Without a winky eye, like
yeah,
a winky
exactly.
face.
On in text, it's like when you get a message from someone and you're like, I don't know whether they're joking or not.
They're
you're
my favourite text to
yeah.
send.
Yeah, of course they are.
My favourite
ambiguous text.
My favourite text to send is the emoji thumbs up because it's so passive aggressive. If anyone says anything, you're just like, have one of those.
That's also the ultimate dad move.
Oh no.
It is a proper dad move, just thumbs up.
Speaking of passive-aggressive ultimate dad.
Oh, I see.
What a segue.
Right, is anyone else really nervous about today's episode?
I'm excited.
I'm excited, equally excited as I am nervous, because today's guest is somebody that, again, we've known for a very long time. We know,
I'm going to put a date on it, 19 years.
Mine's just 19 years, the day I met him as well, probably. And the stories that this man tells are things that you can't repeat.
It's one of the biggest pros and biggest cons of having him is that whenever you pick up a camera, you never know what's going to happen.
But it's all great content.
Yeah.
He's a diamond. It's our most suggested guest so far on this podcast. This is our chat with Chef Kush.
He's also just had a baby, so he's going to be very tired and very unhinged.
Hello, Kush.
Hello,
hi, boys.
Does this feel weird?
Slightly. There are people over there that I can't see, but I know they're listening.
I don't think we've ever had like a formal sit-down chat.
This is casual. It's the pub. It's the Bell's End. Well, we've got pork scratchings.
You remember the job interview, so...
Yeah.
That was formal.
You called me a molester.
Yeah, and I learned what colour your genitalia is.
So. Welcome. You got the job. You're on board.
So what we do with everyone, we ask them about your ultimate foodgasm. So that is a place, a piece of food or a dish that you're eating. Who are you with? What's the scenario? What is going to deliver that ultimate moment when it comes to food?
I think for me, it's going to be in the future.
Okay.
It'll be next spring.
Oh, that's quite specific. Okay.
It's going to
a year from now.
A year from now-ish, the first occasion that I can whack the pizza oven and barbecue out and get my daughter to eat my cooking outside in the sun with my wife and some wine at home.
That's lovely.
I like that.
With no one else there.
So what? Talk specifically about the food.
The food, sourdough pizza.
Yeah.
Cooked in my Uni Pro 16 on my patio. Some slow-cooked, smoked lamb shoulder-style tacos in the Big Weber.
Yeah. Cool, this is brand heavy, isn't it?
Someone's looking for a sponsorship. Oh, yeah.
He's seen James Curry's Instagram.
I just need more coal and wood. I'd walk across to the pub that's across from my house and go get a pint for myself. Currently, I'm on Rebellion Black.
What's that?
It looks like Guinness, but it's 5.2%.
Okay.
So, this is spoken like a true new dad.
Yeah.
Yep.
We've got a pub on our estate that is run by the community. So the pints are £4. There's happy hour. There's a disco. There's darts. I do big barbecues now and again. So
this sounds perfect.
Literally walk across like... there, bring drinks home.
Could we buy that community pub? Because that feels like the kind of thing that...
Could we just record a podcast in it?
Yeah.
Literally, could record a podcast. Could do a live there.
It sounds like the Bell's End, but better.
Well, yeah.
It's without called the Pavilion.
The
because it's on the cricket pitch next to the tennis courts.
Wow.
That's less food pun based though. So yeah. We need to work on
We've
that.
Got an orchard though. So if we time it right, we can go scrumping and foraging.
Yeah.
And I've got a kitchen garden.
Well, seeing as we're in our pub here,
right.
I'd like to move us straight on to what you are drinking because that looks interesting. You've brought your own.
I've brought my own.
BYOB.
Yeah. So it's been a long 3 weeks. It's Barocca and Red Bull mixed together.
That is your coping mechanism.
Yeah.
I'm so on that.
Coffee's just not hitting the spot.
No, you do need something a little bit extra than coffee. Yeah, the Red Bull.
I thought beer might be the answer at one point, but half an Asahi.
Sleepy.
No. Ruined.
It really, makes you fall asleep. Yeah. Right, let's get into this. Yeah. Let's get into this.
Because we've got so many questions.
I've got questions.
Yeah, I don't feel like we've ever had proper answers for. We've touched upon so many different things in videos and your background and where you're from and how you got to here. But I just put something out on Instagram yesterday and asked the community if they had some time with you, what would they want to ask? And we got so many questions and they all revolve around certain themes. And I want to touch on all of them in the next few minutes.
Let's go straight in.
Right.
When was the first time you laid eyes on Ben Ebrell? What was your first interaction with him and what was your thought process at the time?
First time I laid eyes on him would have been, we went to university a week before university started for a little catch-up course because we were the school lot meeting the college lot for catering. So a very quiet campus and halls with, I think, 30 of us there. So I saw Ben across the car park, I assume. He had a notebook out, you know, just sketching out how many paces to the gate so he wouldn't be late for lectures. I was setting up my speakers that were too big for my room and my big office chair because I like loud music. So we went to Birmingham College of Food, Tourism and Creative Studies.
Okay.
As part of that, there was also health and beauty and hairdressing.
So neither of you took advice from that part of the
school then? Right. No. But Ben being thrifty, as am I, he went to the community style teaching hairdressers and had
for a haircut?
For like a £4 haircut.
£4 haircut.
Okay.
And he still goes back, clearly.
Yeah.
And he turned up for, it might have been the first week of full lectures then, with 8 different grades on one side of his head. And that was it.
Because unintentionally or unknowingly, we essentially handed Ebbers over to you at the age of 18 to look after him for a few years and then give him back to us.
It was all part of the plan, yeah.
We didn't expect to take him back, but, you know, no return season.
Well, I rode him. I rode him for 4 years.
You, what?
So we worked together on all our coursework. I rode on his back.
Right. Oh, okay.
Yeah, cool.
Makes sense.
He'd start the plan, write everything down, delegate out. I'd look backwards from when I had to hand it in and then just try and plan it into midnight the night before and just give him all the creative stuff, and he did the due diligence and put it all together and stitch it together.
Standing on the shoulders of Ebbers.
Yeah, yeah.
Perfect.
He worked hours and hours and hours and smashed through his dissertation. I was at the pub by midday, some Tuesdays, and we both got the same result. So I take that as a win.
A net win.
Yeah.
Net
he did get a special commendation at graduation where he got to go off on stage twice.
For what?
Being Ben? I think they made a whole award just for him.
Well, yeah, they do have a statue of him now, don't they?
They do, college. Yeah, small one.
So how did you end up at the university? Like, what led you to want to go into food?
Yeah, did you
food?
Just love food from growing up? So, was it a massive family thing?
Yeah.
How did you get
massive family
food?
Thing. So my maternal grandparents were restaurateurs, opened restaurants globally. Together they opened the first sit-down a la carte Indian restaurant in India. Oh, so wow. As in like a formal dining space that is still to this day in Connaught Place in Delhi. So that's my mum's side. My mum's brother is a chef or was a chef. My dad's side, massively into food as well.
So if you'd gone into anything else, you would have been a disappointment, essentially.
I was very lucky in the fact that I had the choice. I gave myself the choice when I was like 15. When you're doing your GCSEs and A-level like kind of choices, I was like, right, aeronautical and mechanical engineering. So I love cars, trains and planes, or become a chef. I needed maths, physics and chemistry at A level to do one, and I needed nothing to do the other. So I said, I'll go become a chef.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I used to go home from school when I was 15.
Right.
My mum would have texted me in the daytime saying, what do you want for dinner? She'd go out, buy it, all the food, pick me up, take me home, and I'd cook myself a steak with a creamy mushroom sauce, never having cooked a steak or creamy mushroom sauce before. And thinking back, it was a frying pan with a massive ribeye in it, Jamie. A whole 300 ml of cream, sliced mushrooms and garlic, and just it was like a steaky, creamy soup.
The oil in the pan.
Yeah, it was delicious, but no wonder my thighs used to rub together when I was a bit younger. So that was it. Yeah, I used to relax after school by cooking.
Really?
And that became my hobby, and it became a nerdist obsession, as my dad says. Like, I don't talk about much else other than food.
So you graduate from university.
Graduate from university.
What's the first job that you go into after that? What was it? Like, was it a professional kitchen you went straight into?
So while at university, we had a year. Our second year was all we were all working
placement.
Yeah. Ben went to Ireland to work in a castle because he liked Harry Potter at the stage, or Hermione, I don't know. And I went to work in St Albans in North London, kind of
where we
were neck of the woods. Yeah. So I literally got thrown in the deep end at a hotel that wasn't really well managed, and a bit of banqueting, doing weddings for 450 people.
Hotel was it? Because I'm staying there.
Stockwell House.
Not going there, but I have been there a lot. Yeah.
So we used to when I worked as a teacher, we used to host the sixth form graduation ball at Stockwell House.
Yeah,
I wonder if you catered for my nana and granddad's 60th wedding anniversary, actually.
Probably. So that was my university experience. Before that, I'd done, obviously, Burger King, worked at a supermarket and a fruit and veg, you know, started at grassroots level. Graduated and then went and applied to, I think, every Michelin-star restaurant south of Birmingham, so a bit closer to home, and got rejected by every single one of them, saying, not enough experience, not enough experience, not enough experience.
But from that first moment, you wanted to go in right at the sort of the top end of fine dining. That's where you wanted to be?
One or two Michelin-star, yeah. Because at university, we got taught the wording and how to do things, but never the practical actual application. And so if I'd started at a lower level, I'd have had a lot further to go to get to where I wanted to be.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I applied and they all just said no. Then my mum got involved. Her fellow teacher's son was the kitchen manager at Le Manoir. I'd applied there and been rejected. So she got on hold of Rosemary, who got on hold of Andy Fuchs, who's a great chef, used to work at the Fat Duck, then Le Manoir. He went into the kitchen and it was a yes and a no pile on CVs. And he found mine in the no and said, well, he's got good education, give him a chance. Then I got an email saying, come in for an interview.
Went there, stayed at a B&B, turned up for my interview in a full suit.
Yeah, well played.
Yeah. instantly, right, change of rooms, put your whites on. I'm like, great. There was one other person interviewing as well. He turned up in a t-shirt and tracky bottoms. I over-seasoned my risotto that I cooked on the second day.
So yeah, I was going to say, like the interview process for what, 2 Michelin star at the time?
2 Michelin star.
It was make a risotto?
No, so it was a 2-day trial. Okay. So you work in the restaurant kitchens for 2 days. And on the second day, they say to every chef that that goes through, make a vegetarian main course in 1 hour.
Okay.
And
like sorted. No wonder you're so good here.
90% of the chefs go through that I learned, having been there 4 years, was they make a risotto because you flap and you panic.
Yeah.
So it's like, right, rice is the base, all the lovely seasonal veg from all the gardens, but I seasoned my stock. So every time I added it in, I was like, oh, it's getting a bit salty. And then it got to the point where I can't finish it with Parmesan to make it that lovely creaminess because it's already too salty. And so I literally walked the dish up and I presented it to the executive head chef, the sous chef, they're having a meeting. And I was like, it's too salty. And they ate it, said, it is. And he said, you look really gutted. And I am, can I have another go? He's like, yeah, you got half an hour. So I legged it back, did the same thing again, seasoned it well. A few hours later, called me into the office and said, you could tell that you were distraught. Like I was, you know, this is my big chance, my one interview that I had. But because you asked to have another go, you got the job.
Brilliant.
Wow. So it's mindset.
Definitely.
And sort of like your determination.
And also showing the passion, I guess it's showing the passion.
Yeah, it's mindset over actual physical or capability at the time. You can teach that. But the mindset is built in from the beginning, isn't it? So
what had the biggest influence on you over that time? Like, what did you learn? Was there a particular chef there that helped you? And also I want your biggest cock-ups as well and things that went wrong and how you learned from those things.
So I was there for 4 years. It was 2 years in the kitchen, then 2 years doing development for Raymond. In the kitchen, I learned that it's not like you see it on TV at all, in any TV show, even the really like real ones.
Yeah, fly on the walls.
Yeah, you'll go in and you'll prep 8 Savoy cabbages, and then you'll have to make mashed potato, then you'll have to do this and this, and the same thing you'll do the next day, and the next week, and the next month. Biggest influence, there was the head chef at the time, Carl Newbury. Fantastic guy, saw that I was really low at one point and sat me down and said, you're doing really well, but no one's actually said it to you, have they? Like, no. And I was like, I was nearly in tears at this point because I was just broken about a year in. And he said, you're doing really well. Like, you've come out of a university background with no actual real experience and you're doing this. And then literally I was at my lowest point and I started flying after that. I was really happy.
Can we talk about that for a second?
Yeah.
What was it that was getting you down? Because I've heard, and I know Slater talked about it quite a bit as well when he was working in sort of professional kitchens and things. It was like, just from a mental health aspect, there wasn't much support. You're kind of feeling like you're on your own. Like, what was it that got you down?
So it's a combination of, there's no feedback loop when you do something well in those environments. You're expected just to do it. So you start at 7:30 in the morning. You have a half an hour break at 4 p.m. for your food, and then you finish at midnight, 1 a.m. And you do that 5 days in a row. So you're essentially broken on your days off, and you do that repetition. But you compound that with, it's 35 to 40 degrees Celsius in the kitchen. Everything's hot or cold in the freezers and the fridges, and you are being shouted at quite a bit, and it's such high paced. I have beautiful athletic calves because I stood on my tiptoes for 4 years, just bouncing around, always on edge, just there and obviously other restaurants, but you're always at that level. So when you turn off on your weekends, you really turn off, but then it has to go straight back up. And that just slowly wears you down and down and down. There are a couple of chefs there that really, you know, did like to put the knife in. They got sacked in the end. So the really low occasion was, I was getting bullied by one chef in particular. Beasted. It was really hard. Was on the hot starters section, so doing all the risottos, all the hot starters, and so you were doing up to 100 covers a night, which is a lot for a 2 Michelin star restaurant. And on my break at 4-ish, I went over to the staff canteen area, went upstairs, rang my dad. I used to speak to him every other day or so, and he said, "What's wrong?" And I literally broke down.
Yeah.
And about 40 minutes later, he was saying, "You've got to go tell your exec chef. Go tell Gary Jones. I got to say something, they'll understand." And I was like, yes, of course I will. I wasn't going to, because I was just like, no, you don't do that. So I hung up, wiped my eyes, turned around, and Carl, the head chef, was sitting on a sofa. And I then remembered he takes a power nap every single day on that sofa for 40 minutes. So he'd listened to the whole thing. As with no filter, I was telling my dad, so I'd been totally honest, and he listened to the whole thing. Then he walked me round to a bench in the little church next door and sat me down and literally said, no, you're doing really well. I'm really sorry that you feel like this, didn't know. And then on, he checked on me every day. And then all I needed was that little boost of saying, no, you're doing fantastic.
Yeah,
you're running a section a year into working at a 2-star restaurant and you've had no real experience at this level before.
What, you hear a lot about the culture of a professional kitchen. And it's clear that you've picked up so much of that mentality, in that you've got an amazing sense of humor that comes in whenever, like it's during the most peak stressy moments of even with what we're doing here, but also like a ruthless efficiency. In terms of that environment in a professional kitchen, I know it's probably a balance between the amazing banter and that sort of collective team effort, but also that ruthless efficiency. Tell us a little bit about what it was like in your experience and the positives and negatives and how you think that's influenced you with what you're doing or what you did moving forward.
I think efficiency is the biggest thing. Like, I love efficiency to a fault, to the point where I can be quite blunt and terse.
So for example, and this is, I love this, but during our live shows, we sometimes get some, and anyone who's helping, like clear kitchens, or sometimes we have people in to help support you in the food prep for our live shows. And I overheard you talking to a group of them once, which was like, I really appreciate what you're doing and what you're going to be doing, but in order to make this run really quickly and efficiently, I'm going to say please and thank you after we're done, because we need to get this out. So I'm not being rude, I am being direct, but there's no time. And I'd never heard anyone almost say that before going into something, high pressured.
Yeah. So in a professional kitchen, the respect is there because you're all working together as a team, or a brigade in the French system, and a brigade from the army. You're together, you're all fighting for each other. So it's implicit. You need to be direct and you say, this is your task. That's all you have to say. At the end of the day, you'll crack a beer, have a chat, ask how someone's family is, but you don't start the day with that ever.
No.
You don't start the day with, what did you do on the weekend? It's like, how's prep going? What sauce do I need to make?
You're all there. You're all a cog within a machine. Yeah. And every cog has to work perfectly.
It's the focus. And I think that's so different from any other job that I've had, which is we all have those times where you have to focus and get on with it, but it's mixed in with the, let's have a chat, let's do, we'll grab a coffee and talk about something else and kind of thing. And then you go, well, I do need to concentrate now. But it's not hours and hours on end of pure focus, no chit chat until you get to the end of that.
But are there jokes, and I keep on saying banter, I hate that word, but do you have any standout funny memories or moments of your times in those professional kitchens?
We had a piece of pak choy that is cut in half and lightly braise the stem and then flop the leaves in to cook quickly. That would then be chilled. Each layer would be seasoned with some homemade pickled ginger and a bit of soy, and it rolled up with some sesame seeds, and that was then steamed to go on a plate with some organic pork from the Ruger Estate suckling pork. No pak choy was in the building that day, so I had to send one of the sous chefs out to the supermarket, which is about an hour round trip, to go buy pak choy. They went and bought 16 heads of pak choy and drove it back. Because it came in so late, just before service, I rushed to get it all cooked. I then overcooked every single piece of pak choy. And then another chef had to drive out further, because we'd bought everything from that supermarket, to another one and buy it. That was a boo-boo. But then I was forced to eat every single piece. So 32 pieces of overcooked pak choy that day. took me 8 hours. I got a round of applause by the full kitchen, and the sous chef at the time that had forced me to eat it looked really angry.
Wow. What happened? Because you started to work closer with Raymond Blanc, who was the owner of Le Manoir?
He's
the
chef proprietor. So he started it as Le Manoir restaurant in North Oxford. It was like a restaurant on the bottom of a terrace block of apartments, essentially. And then he bought Great Milton Manor, and that became Le Manoir de Quatre Saisons, so the Manor of Four Seasons. So he's still there to this day. The restaurant's had 2 Michelin stars for, I think, 40 years now. I was on Hot Starters, Stir and Risotto, And Raymond asked Gary Jones, executive head chef of the restaurant, I need someone to come and help him and his development chef, Adam, to do development because they're doing more TV work, magazines, etc. Gary, or chef, weird to say Gary, still called him chef in my head, came down to the kitchen in beginning of lunch service. And if he wanted to talk to you without you walking away, he'd just put his foot on your foot. Like, not with any pressure, but he just like, and he'd be like close.
Stop
like
what
there.
You're doing.
Yeah, no, no. Carry on what you're doing, but I'm going to talk to you. Yeah. I think it's a power thing, but you knew what he wanted to have a chat.
So I'm going to start doing that. Yeah. That's great.
So he's in your personal space, but it's quite a confined space anyway, as a kitchen. And he said, he's been asked someone to join him. And he said, I can see that you're a bit bored stirring risotto. Would you like to go and work with him? And I was like, oh, okay. And he said, but I would lose you from the kitchen. And in my head, I was like, yes.
Really? So like, you didn't think I want to work my way up to sous chef here. Like, even at that point, you were like, yeah, let's go do something new.
Yeah, I was like, if I can leave working in the kitchen to go do development and work with a world-renowned chef, but still work at Le Manoir and get all the perks and work at this amazing hotel and restaurant, why not? Yeah. When he said that word, I'd lose you from the kitchen. I was like, wait, so I don't have to do, in my head, instantly, I was like, so no more 18-hour shifts. No more peeling asparagus and polishing copper pans at midnight. Yeah, done.
But does that mean that the dream of working at the highest level in a kitchen to become like a head chef of Le Manoir or a similar...
Was never the dream.
That was never the dream.
No, people always assume that I always wanted to have my own Michelin star, have my own restaurant, be a world famous chef. All I wanted was to be happy. And that changed each year of how I saw myself being happy. As long as I was respected within my field by my peers, I was fine. And the fact that by then
I've
done...
you've lost that now. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't bode well for what you're
doing.
We'll
come into that later.
World famous, yes. Respected.
Mm. Mm. 10,000 Instagram followers.
Yeah.
So
you've changed.
Yeah, I have. Yeah. Look at this branding. So I got asked to go do development. I had to do my own mini interview for that, which was a thing in itself.
Risotto? Yummy.
No.
Yummy.
Write a simple recipe for a dish that uses various seasonal ingredients and cook it. I'd specialise in doing some Moroccan food at university. So I thought, I'll do a Moroccan style roasted rack of lamb on a spice couscous, that kind of thing. It had 26 ingredients in it because herbs and spices all count. Mm. So I wrote the recipe, cooked it, served it, cooked it in front of RB, Raymond, as we call him, and Adam, his chef. And then it got torn apart, basically. Like, well, the recipe, the format is slightly wrong, or it's not how we would do it. I'm like, right, fine. Simple doesn't mean 26 ingredients. But I was like, but it's just lamb, sauce, and couscous. So it is simple in my head. But they meant rack of lamb, peas and asparagus, and a light sauce.
Yeah,
okay.
And then I had to cook a steak and cook an omelette. Those were easy because I just watched his videos online of how
just
he cooked
them.
And copied it. Yeah. And then he literally saw me doing it and came and did it with me because he can't help himself. Working with him directly afforded me travel throughout France and cook throughout France with him for TV series. Got to go and do big, glamorous things like cooking in the windows of Harrods for the first time ever, which was weird. Doing a four-course meal from the lingerie department at Harrods once it had closed.
Wow. Whilst wearing it.
Yeah. Well, wearing nothing. Yeah, weren't allowed clothes in there.
I thought a brasserie was a restaurant. But yeah.
Not having tarragon and having to ask his security guard to run me through Harrods with a torch to the veg area and to nick herbs.
Whilst wearing crotchless panties, yeah.
Yeah. But with Raymond on my back, whipping me. So that was great. And I did that for 2 years till I got a bit bored. Let's be honest.
Okay.
Why?
Like, why? Because I spent more time on a laptop and doing emails with PR and magazines than I did actual cooking. And then I was like, right, I need to go cook again and move and get out of a tiny little village. So I moved to Bath and there was a job available there, senior sous chef at a one Michelin star hotel restaurant, Bath Priory. I applied, went there, did my trial. I was honest, I was like, I've never been a sous chef. I went from commis chef, assistant development chef. He's like, fine, got the job. So did 3 years at Bath Priory, senior sous chef. So we had 16 chefs in the kitchen, including a few in pastry. It was one long rectangle kitchen where Le Manoir was essentially three or four kitchens spread out through our long corridors. Bath Ferrari had two walk-in fridges. Le Manoir had seven. Same amount of covers, though. Did 70 in the restaurant, 30 in the brasserie, 100 on the terrace for afternoon tea in summer and club sandwiches, and 32 bedrooms. Oh,
club sandwich. And did you notice, like, what is the difference between a one-star and a two-star restaurant?
Like, it's subjective.
Fine.
Based so on the Michelin inspector at the time that goes and judges it.
Interesting. So there's no, like, tick list where you can go, we don't need to try as hard, or we don't, you know, we don't need to make this as precise as we would have done in the two Michelin
star place. No, because in the same question, what's the difference between two and three? A lot of people will argue that three is the pinnacle of cooking. Le Manoir was at two for 40 years, but having eaten at three Michelin star restaurants throughout the UK and France and abroad, Le Manoir was still the best food I've ever eaten, seen or cooked. And I knew the processes going into it. So we still don't understand. I say we, not you guys, but all the chefs that have worked at Le Manoir and the industry in the UK still doesn't know why it hasn't had three stars.
Okay.
But it's, some people say Raymond was self-trained, self-taught, never, you know, went through under any other famous chefs, and Michelin don't like that. Is it politics? Maybe. So I don't think there's much of a difference in the food. It can depend on the day. It can depend on your taste individually, the season. Some places do far better in summer because they've got a bountiful, you know, ingredients on their doorstep. But it was a more relaxed kitchen with better management because I was in charge.
Please and thank yous at the end of service.
Yeah. So I worked under Sam Moody, executive head chef there, who I'd say was a real chef, fantastic cook, would take just simple ingredients and turn them into really simple dishes, but elevated with little touches of genius. And he'd cook day in, day out.
Did you learn a lot from him then?
Yeah. Learn a lot on the man management side of it. Had to do all the invoicing. And I had to do the invoicing, a really dull bit on a Sunday because he had Sundays off. I got to play around with the lunch menu every day. He did the a la carte and tasting menus, and we worked together a bit on that. Whole animal butchery that I'd learned at the man while we did there. So we get in whole pigs, whole lambs, half sides of Dexter cows. Dexter being the really small cow, but it's called quite big. So we'd have to utilize the full animal. So all the cheaper cuts, like the bellies and the shoulders, would go on the lunch menu, raise down the hocks and turn them into little canapes and bonbons. All the finer cuts would go on the a la carte menu. So it was a lot of balancing costs as well. Whereas Le Manoir, pretty static, mm-hmm. very expensive. We knew what the food cost was because it was posted on the wall every day, but you couldn't do much to really affect it. Whereas creating a lunch menu that changed every week, I was like, right, we can utilize this, utilize this, utilize this. We can cut out all those processes because we don't need them. No one's learning anything by doing the processes. Let's simplify things.
So would you say like that's where you there was tangible evidence for your skill set being broadened in that role?
I think definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
It was when I turned up, there were 8 lever arch ring binder files of recipes that had been inherited from another two Michelin star restaurant that essentially the chef from there, Michael Caine, had opened the Bath Priory and wanted its star, put Sam in its in as head chef. And looking at the recipes from Gidley Park, the two Michelin star restaurant, they were involved. Like there was a laminated A4 page with the recipe for lemon juice.
What was on it? What's the recipe for
squeeze
lemon
juice? Squeeze lemon sieve.
Okay.
Refrigerate.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. But if that wasn't written, then the follow-on recipes that needed lemon juice wouldn't have worked. That was the thinking about
those processes.
Oh my
goodness, it's
Le
Repertoire de la Cuisine,
yeah,
is, isn't it?
Exactly,
all over
yeah.
again.
So we got rid, we shrunk 8 lever arch files down to like one ring binder that had the core things like the sauces that are quite like this really good recipe for that. Where otherwise we just got rid of them like, oh, I need to make an asparagus soup. The chef would like, I've got a recipe. No, if you can't make an asparagus soup, you really shouldn't be working here. If you can't make it, let's check it every 5 minutes. And that we taught them that way. So a lot of more of my teaching came into it then, like educating the younger generation. I was still relatively young.
How old were you at this point?
Graduated when I was 22. 4 years later, I was 26. So I was 26 to 29.
Wow.
And so that broadening of skills and that kind of exposure to the other side of working in a kitchen, did that make up for going back to the 18-hour shifts?
It wasn't 18 hours there.
Oh.
No, started at 9. Half an hour break in the morning, half an hour break in the afternoon, 2 hour split shift. So 3 till 5, we were gone and finished at 10.
It's a bit more relaxed.
They got me into wine drinking there as well. There was a great wine shop called The Tasting Room and Bar. That's sadly closed now. Went in there in my first week. Just come from Waitrose, my bag of shopping. Walked in and said, I've got £10. I want a bottle of red that I can open now and drink while I cook. Will, the owner, said...
We've met him, haven't we? We've been to the tasting rooms.
You have, yeah.
Off of your recommendation. So. Yeah.
He pulled a bottle of wine off the shelf, £7, Aussie red. So there you go. I said, oh, I can spend a bit more. He said, no, drink that. If you like it, come back. We'll go up. 3 years later, I'm buying £28 bottles of Barolo. And I had a good friend. So...
he got you, mate.
Yeah.
He absolutely got you.
Started making my own biltong while I was there. And I used to trade biltong and beer sticks for beer with the craft beer shop, a guy called Chris Scullion, Independent Spirit. So made friends and grew up, I think, there.
It's fascinating that you've been, that you had all of this hard work, big hours, cooking all the time. And yet the single thing that you wanted to do in your spare time was make biltong, cook. I mean, in the intro to this, Edwards was saying that you'd finish a shift at Le Manoir, and on your day off, he'd come round and you'd cook him a four-course dinner.
Yeah, so back then it was using techniques that I'd just learned and seeing what they were
wanting
like.
To try them out.
Yeah. I was cooking in my mum's kitchen back in Berkshire then, so didn't have sous vide, didn't have any of that. So I used to sous vide, though, by rolling things in cling film.
Guinea pig, basically. Yeah. I love that.
I used to do mad things. Like I'd flatten out a full pork fillet and then line it with chorizo and herbs and roll it back up like a pinwheel. Then roll that in cling film. I'd set the oven at like 100 degrees Celsius, a gas oven, and put a big cast iron Le Creuset pan of water in there. And I had a probe. So I'd get that water to the right temperature and then hold
That's
the oven.
That's how you were sous-vide-ing.
And then put the pork in and a bit, leave it for 4 hours. And I was buying everything from the supermarket. So it's costing quite a bit. And Ben would have been gone in the morning because he had to come back for work.
And so like finishing at Bath, how did you end up on a private yacht of a billionaire during COVID?
So I...
I mean, that's a question that
I've done.
Yeah. Research.
Yeah. Well, that feels like a good place to end the first part of that chat.
Yeah, this has now become a two-parter because there is so much more still to talk about. So make sure that you're following Under the Cloche wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe. Part two will be coming to you with the one and only Kush.